The Slim Princess. I. Woman in Moravinia. Moravinia is a state in which both the mosque and the motorcar now occur in the same landscape. It started out to be Turkish and later decided to be European. The Mohammedan sanctuaries with their hideous stencil decorations and bulbous domes are jostled by many new shops with blinking fronts and German merchandise. The Orthodox turn their faces toward Mecca while the enlightened dream of a journey to Paris. Men of title lately have made the pleasing discovery that they may drink champagne and still be good Muslims. The red slipper has been succeeded by the tangator. The voluminous breeches now acknowledge the superior graces of intimate English trousers. Frock coats are more conventional than beaded jackets. The fez remains as a part of the insignia of the old faith and hereditary devotion to the sick man. The generation of males which has been extricating itself from the shackles of Orientalism has not devoted much worry to the condition of woman. In Moravinia, woman is still unliberated. She does not dine at a palm garden or hop into a Victoria on Thursday afternoon to go to the meeting of a club organized to propagate cults. If she met a cult face to face, she would not recognize it. Nor does she suspect, as she sits in her prison apartment, peeping out through the lattice at the monotonous drift of the street life, that her sisters in faraway Michigan are organizing and raising missionary funds in her behalf. She does not read the dressmaking periodicals. She never heard of the Wednesday matinee. When she takes the air, she rides in a carriage that has a sheltering hood, and she is veiled up to the eyes, and she must never lean out to wriggle her little fingertips at men lolling in front of the cafes. She must not see the men. She may look at them, but she must not see them. No wonder the sisters in Michigan are organizing to batter down the walls of tradition, and bring to her the more recent privileges of her sex. 2 years ago, when this story had its real beginning, the social status of woman in Moravinia was not greatly different from what it is today, or what it was 2 centuries ago. Woman had two important duties assigned to her. One was to hide herself from the gaze of the multitude, and the other was to be beautiful, that is, fat. A woman who was plump, or buxom, or chubby might be classed as passably attractive, but only the fat women were irresistible. A woman weighing 200 pounds was only two-thirds as beautiful as one weighing 300. Those grading below 150 were verging upon the impossible. 2. Calora's affliction. If it had been planned to make this an old-fashioned discursive novel, say of the Victor Hugo variety, the second chapter would expend itself upon a philosophical discussion of fat and a sensational showing of how and why the presence or absence of adipose tissue, at certain important crises, had altered the destinies of the whole race. The subject offers vast possibilities. It involves the physical attractiveness of every woman in history and permits one to speculate wildly as to what might have happened if Cleopatra had weighed 40 pounds heavier, if Elizabeth had been a gaunt and wiry creature, or if Joan of Arc had been so bulky that she could not have fastened on her armor. The soft layers which enshroud the hard machinery of the human frame seem to arrive in a merely incidental or accidental sort of way. Yet once they have arrived, they exert a mysterious influence over careers. Because of a mere change in contour, many a queen has lost her throne. It is a terrifying thought when one remembers that fat so often comes and so seldom goes. It has been explained that in Moravinia, obesity and feminine beauty increased in the same ratio. The woman reigning in the hearts of men was the one who could displace the most atmosphere. Because of the fashionableness of fat, Count Selim Malagasy, Governor General of Moravinia, was very unhappy. He had two daughters. One was fat, one was thin. To be more explicit, one was gloriously fat and the other was distressingly thin. Janika was the name of the one who had been blessed abundantly. Several of the younger men in official circles, who had seen Janika at a distance, when she waddled to her carriage or turned sidewise to enter a shop door, had written verses about her in which they compared her to the blushing pomegranate, the ripe melon, the luscious grape, and other vegetable luxuries more or less globular in form. No one had dedicated any verses to Calora. Calora was the elder of the two. She had come to the alarming age of 19 and no one had started in bidding for her. In court circles, where there is much time for idle gossip, the most intimate secrets of an important household are often bandied about when the black coffee is being served. The marriageable young men of Moravinia had learned of the calamity in Count Malagasy's family. They knew that Calora weighed less than 120 pounds. She was tall, lithe, slender, sinuous, willowy, hideous. The fact that poor old Count Malagasy had made many unsuccessful attempts to fatten her was a stock subject for jokes of an unrefined and Turkish character. Whereas Janika would recline for hours at a time on a shaded veranda, munching sugary confections that were loaded with nutritious nuts, Calori showed a far Western preference for pickles and olives, and had been detected several times in the act of bribing servants to bring this contraband food into the harem. Worse still, she insisted upon taking exercise. She loved to play romping games within the high walls of the enclosure where she and the other female attachés of the royal household were kept penned up. Her father coaxed, pleaded and even threatened, but she refused to lead the indolent life prescribed by custom. She scorned the sweet and heavy foods which would enable her to expand into loveliness. She persistently declined to be fat. Calori's education was being directed by a superannuated professor named Popova. He was so antique and bookwormy that none of the usual objections urged against the male sex seemed to hold good in his case, and he had the free run of the palace. Count Selim Malagasy trusted him implicitly. Popova fawned upon the governor-general, and seemed slavish in his devotion. Secretly and stealthily he was working out a frightful vengeance upon his patron. 20 years before, Count Selim, in a moment of anger, had called Popova Christian dog. In Moravinia it is flattery to call a man a liar. It is just the same as saying to him, "You belong in the diplomatic corps." It is no disgrace to be branded as a thief, because all business transactions are saturated with treachery. But to call another a Christian dog is the 33rd degree of insult. Popova writhed in spirit when he was called Christian. But he covered his wrath and remained in the nobleman's service and waited for his revenge. And now he was sacrificing the innocent Calori in order to punish the father. He said to himself, "If she does not fatten, then her father's heart will be broken, and he will suffer even as I have suffered from being called Christian." It was Popova who, by guarded methods, encouraged her to violent exercise, whereby she became as hard and trim as an antelope. He continued to supply her with all kinds of sour and biting foods and sharp mineral waters, which are the sworn enemies of any sebaceous condition. And now that she was 19, almost at the further boundary of the marrying age, and slimmer than ever before, he rejoiced greatly, for he had accomplished his deep and malign purpose, and laid a heavy burden of sorrow upon Count Selim Malagasy. 3. The cruelty of law. If the father was worried by the prolonged crisis, the younger sister, Janika, was well nigh distracted, for she could not hope to marry until Calori had been properly mated and sent away. In Moravinia there is a very strict law intended to eliminate the spinster from the social horizon. It is a law born of craft and inspired by foresight. The daughters of a household must be married off in the order of their nativity. The younger sister dare not contemplate matrimony until the elder sister has been led to the altar. It is impossible for a young and attractive girl to make a desirable match leaving a maiden sister marooned on the market. She must cooperate with her parents and with the elder sister to clear the way. As a rule, this law encourages earnest getting together in every household and results in a clearing up of the entire stock of eligible daughters. But think of the unhappy lot of an adorable and much coveted maiden who finds herself wedged in behind something unattractive and shelf-worn. Janika was thus pocketed. She could do nothing except fold her hands and patiently wait for some miraculous intervention. In Moravinia the discreet marrying age is about 16. Janika was 18, still young enough and of a most ravishing weight. But the slim princess stood as a slight, yet seemingly insurmountable barrier between her and all hopes of conventional happiness. Count Malagasy did not know that the shameful fact of Calori's thinness was being whispered among the young men of Moravinia. When the daughters were out for their daily carriage ride both wore flowing robes. In the case of Calori, this augmented costume was intended to conceal the absence of noble dimensions. It is not good form in Moravinia for a husband or father to discuss his home life, or to show enthusiasm on the subject of mere woman, but the Count, prompted by a fretful desire to dispose of his rapidly maturing offspring, often remarked to the high-born young gentleman of his acquaintance that Calori was a most remarkable girl and one possessed of many charms, leaving them to infer, if they cared to do so, that possibly she weighed at least 180 pounds. /020.png, Popova rejoiced greatly. These casual comments did not seem to arouse any burning curiosity among the young men, and up to the day of Calori's 19th anniversary they had not had the effect of bringing to the father any of those guarded inquiries which, under the Oriental custom, are always preliminary to an actual proposal of marriage. Count Selim Malagasy had a double reason for wishing to see Calori married. While she remained at home he knew that he would be second in authority. There is an Occidental misapprehension to the effect that every woman beyond the borders of the Levant is a languorous and waxen lily, floating in a milk-warm pool of idleness. It is true that the women of a household live in certain apartments set aside as a harem. But harem literally means forbidden, that is, forbidden to the public, nothing more. Every villa at Newport has a harem. The women of Moravinia do not pour tea for men every afternoon, and they are kept well under cover, But they are not slaves. They do not inherit a nominal authority, but very often they assume a real authority. In the United States, women cannot sail a boat, and yet they direct the crews of the yacht. Railway presidents cannot vote in the Senate, and yet they always know how the votes are going to be cast. And in Moravinia, many a clever woman, deprived of specified and legal rights, has learned to rule men by those tactful methods which are in such general use that they need not be specified in this connection. Calora had a way of getting around her father. After she had defied him and put him into a stewing rage, she would smooth him the right way and, with teasing little cajoleries, nurse him back to a pleasant humor. He would find himself once more at the starting place of the controversy, his stern commands unheeded, and the disobedient daughter laughing in his very face. Thus, while he was ashamed of her physical imperfections, he admired her cleverness. Often he said to Popova, "I tell you, she might make some man a sprightly and entertaining companion, even if she is slender." Whereupon the crafty Popova would reply, "Be patient, Your Excellency. We shall yet have her as round as a dumpling." And all the time he was keeping her trained as fine as the proverbial fiddle. 4. The garden party. Said the Governor General to himself in that prime hour for wide awake meditation, the one just before rising for breakfast, "She is not all that she should be, and yet, millions of women have been less than perfect and most of them have married." He looked hard at the ceiling for a full minute and then murmured, "Even men have their shortcomings." This declaration struck him as being sinful and almost infidel in its radicalism, and yet it seemed to open the way to a logical reason why some titled bachelor of damaged reputation and tottering finances might balance his poor assets against a dowry and a social position, even though he would be compelled to figure Calora into the bargain. It must be known that the Governor-General was now simply looking for a husband for Calora. He did not hope to top the market or bring down any notable catch. He favored any alliance that would result in no discredit to his noble lineage. "At present they do not even nibble," he soliloquized, still looking at the ceiling. "They have taken fright for some reason. They may have an inkling of the awful truth. She is 19. Next year she will be 20, the year after that 21. Then it would be too late. A desperate experiment is better than inaction. I have much to gain and nothing to lose. I must exhibit Calora. I shall bring the young men to her. Some of them may take a fancy to her. I have seen people eat sugar on tomatoes and pepper on ice cream. There may be in Moravinia one would be sufficient, one bachelor who is no stickler for full-blown loveliness. I may find a man who has become inoculated with Western heresies and believes that a woman with intellect is desirable, even though underweight. I may find a fool, or an aristocrat who has gambled. I may stumble upon good fortune if I put her out among the young men. Yes, I must exhibit her, but how? He began reaching into thin air for a pretext and found one. The inspiration was simple and satisfying. He would give a garden party in honor of Mr. Raleigh Plumston, the British consul. Of course he would have to invite Mrs. Plumston and then, out of deference to European custom, he would have his two daughters present. It was only by the use of imported etiquette that he could open the way to direct courtship. Possibly some of the cautious young noblemen would talk with Calora, and, finding her bright-eyed, witty, ready in conversation and with enthusiasm for big and masculine undertakings, be attracted to her. At the same time her father decided that there was no reason why her pitiful shortage of avoirdupois should be candidly advertised. Even at a garden party, where the guests of honor are two English subjects, the young women would be required to veil themselves up to the nose tips and hide themselves within a veritable cocoon of soft garments. The invitations went out and the acceptances came in. The English were flattered. Count Malagasy was buoyed by new hopes and the daughters were in a day and night flutter, for neither of them had ever come within speaking distance of the real young man of their dreams. On the morning of the day set apart for the debut of Calora, Count Selim went to her apartments, and, with a rather shamefaced reluctance, gave his directions. "Calora, I have done all for you that any father could do for a beloved child and you are still thin," he began. "Slender," she corrected. "Thin," he repeated. "Thin as a crane, a mere shadow of a girl, and, what is more deplorable, apparently indifferent to the sorrow that you are causing those most interested in your welfare." "I am not indifferent, father. If, merely by wishing, I could be fat, I would make myself the shape of the French balloon that floated over Moravinia last week. I would be so roly-poly that, when it came time for me to go and meet our guests this afternoon, I would roll into their presence as if I were a tennis ball." "Why should you know anything about tennis balls? You, of all the young women in Moravinia, seem to be the only one with a fondness for athletics. I have heard that in Great Britain, where the women ride and play rude, manly games, there has been developed a breed as hard as Flynn. Allah preserve me from such women. Father, you are leading up to something. What is it you wish to say?
This. You have persistently disobeyed me and made me very unhappy, but today I must ask you to respect my wishes. Do not proclaim to our guests the sad truth regarding your deficiency.
Good. She exclaimed gaily. I shall wear a robe the size of an Arabian tent, and I shall surround myself with soft pillows, and I shall wheeze when I breathe and, who knows? Perhaps some dark-eyed young man worth a million piastres will be deceived, and will come to you tomorrow, and buy me at so much a pound. And she shrieked with laughter.
Stop! Commanded her father. You refuse to take me seriously, but I am in earnest. Do not humiliate me in the presence of my friends this afternoon.
Then he hurried away before she had time to make further sport of him. To Count Salim Malagasy, this garden party was the frantic effort of a sinking man. To Gloria it was a lark. From the pure fun of the thing, she obeyed her father. She wore four heavily quilted and padded gowns, one over another, and when she and Janika were summoned from their apartments and went out to meet the company under the trees, they were almost like twins and both duck-like in general outlines. First they met Mrs. Raleigh Plumston, a very tall, bony and dignified woman in grey, wearing a most flowery hat. To every man of Moravinia, Mrs. Plumston was the apotheosis of all that was undesirable in her sex, but they were exceedingly polite to her, for the reason that Moravinia owed a great deal of money in London and it was a set policy to cultivate the friendship of the British. While Janika and Calora were being presented to the consul's wife, these same young men, the very flower of bachelorhood, stood back at a respectful distance and regarded the young women with half-concealed curiosity. To be permitted to inspect young women of the upper classes was a most unusual privilege, and they knew why the privilege had been extended to them. It was all very amusing, but they were too well-bred to betray their real emotions. When they moved up to be